get when you mix two Game Boys, a guitar, and a composer inspired by bands like Metallica. Buffalo's own Danimal Cannon, who came to the WBFO studios to play some songs, talk about his current endeavors, his love for chiptune music, and, well, really what it is. I'm Nick Lippa, and we're here to talk to Danimal today.
Talk.
Yeah, let's talk. So introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Danimal Cannon. I am a musician and composer for video games, and sometimes I write music on video game hardware. I just performed using the Nintendo Game Boys.
Yeah, Game Boys and guitar and this thing called chiptune. Let's tell the kids at home what chiptune is.
So back when you would play video games back in the 80s and 90s, the video game consoles would have these sound chips built into them so they could have sound. Like, they could have sound effects and they could have music. You know, you have your Mario theme, Legend of Zelda theme, stuff like that. And essentially what I'm doing is I'm hijacking that sound chip to use as my own instrument to write my own music on. And they sound surprisingly cool.
This is your song Chronos from your album Parallel Processing. I'd say it's pretty cool, but I'm biased. I'm a gamer, and I tend to like this music.
It's pretty strange. Most of the time, people, you know, I have this weird fear when I talk to them that I tell them that, yeah, I make music on Game Boys, and they're not going to take me seriously, and they're not wrong to do that because it is ridiculous. But a lot of people associate that sort of sound with a really sort of chintzy 8-bit lo-fi sound. But honestly, if you use some clever programming and some tricks, you can get some really huge and interesting sounds out of them. And honestly, in the chiptune scene, that's what we call ourselves, people who make that sort of music, it's almost like a competition to see who can come up with the craziest, raddest sound using those pieces of hardware.
And let's talk about that, because there isn't just kind of like one chiptune genre that you have. There's different sounding chiptune.
Right. So chiptune is more of an instrument than it is a genre. You can make any kind of music. You can make EDM music using a Nintendo. You can make heavy metal music making a Game Boy, or vice versa. I know people that make jazz music using video game hardware. It's really just an instrument like a keyboard or a guitar, and it's what the musician brings to the instrument. And it's really interesting to see the different things that people do with certain pieces of hardware. And I happen to make chiptune, progressive, heavy metal most of the time.
Give a little background on yourself. How'd you get into doing chiptune and playing guitar?
So how far back should I go? So back when I was 12 or so, I got a Metallica tape, and I got this Metallica Live album that has a curse word in it, so I'm not going to say it. But
I mean, you can curse if you want.
Well, it's called Live Shit, Binge and Purge, and I watched the videos for that, and because it came with these VHS tapes of live shows, and I was like, well, I have to play guitar now. That's just how it works. You can't be a 12-year-old and watch Metallica tapes in their prime in 1989 and 1991 and not want to play guitar. I'm sure there's literally a generation of kids that picked up a guitar because of those pieces of media, and I'm one of them. And I was a heavy metal kid in the 90s, sort of thrash metal went by the wayside. I still loved it, but more electronic, like industrial music, came into fashion, and nu metal, unfortunately, also came into fashion. But I was slightly influenced by those things, so I really enjoyed electronic music in addition to sort of the more classic heavy metal roots. And at some point, I was, let's see, I should probably rewind a little bit and also say that I was a big video game nerd as a kid. All I would do when I wasn't watching Metallica VHS tapes was I was playing my Nintendo. And those were kind of my two things that I was into. And my parents told me that I was going to grow out of video games, so I never got another system beyond the Nintendo, the Nintendo Entertainment System, the first one. So I, throughout high school, even through part of college, all I ever played was the regular Nintendo. I had a Game Boy, too, but I only had that because we won that in a contest. But anyways, since I played games all those years, I kind of had a thing for video game music. A lot of Nintendo arrangements, the hardware is kind of almost set up like a band. You have your two pulse channels, and those are your two leads, like two guitars. And you have your triangle channel, and a lot of times that's the bass. And then you have your noise channel, it's the drums. It's a lot of old Nintendo songs are almost arranged like you would a rock band, except they have like this sense of melody to them that it's more complex than you find in traditional sort of rock music. So I really love the rock arrangement of it, but they had this complex musicality to it that didn't really hear anywhere else except for video game music. I'm thinking like Castlevania tracks, Mega Man tracks. You hear songs from those games, and you can pick them out instantaneously. They don't sound like anything else. Exactly. That Mega Man Gallop, which I ripped off in my song Roots, very, very on purpose. It's a very iconic thing with Castlevania. You have your Baroque neoclassical rock sort of arrangements. And so I used to try to convince my band at the time to cover songs from the Nintendo on rock instruments, on guitars and drums, and I wanted to make it real loud, and I loved the melodies. They had been stuck in my head for years, and I did that for a long time. Actually, I formed a band that all we did was that. It's called Arm Cannon, and we formed in 2005 or 2006, and we're still around today. And
I notably also had Metal Metroid as well as
Metroid Metal. Yes. So Metroid Metal, actually, there was a forum that I joined. It was a guy named Stemmage who was making remakes of Metroid songs in a metal format, and I joined his forum in 2003, and I would chat about video games and video game music, and it was a little subculture around heavy metal and video game music, and I really just fell down the rabbit hole, and I'd go check this forum every day, and I became friends with all the members. There was a music festival that I played called MagFest. It was the Music and Gaming Festival in Washington, D.C., and the guy who runs Metroid Metal, his name is Grant Henry, and he came to the festival, and he saw Arm Cannon play, and we met, we hung out, we had a few beers, and he was like, hey, what if we did a couple of Metroid Metal songs live? And I was like, I will learn them as long as you can get a band that can, you know, play the rhythm section, because the rhythms are really difficult in those tracks. He went out of his way to make them extra, just extra. That's how I would put it. But I ended up somehow being in two video game cover bands through being a giant internet nerd and a video game nerd and a heavy metal nerd. All of my worlds were colliding as one. And this is a long story, actually, I'm noticing. When I was learning to arrange tracks from the Nintendo, I learned a lot about the video game hardware itself. I would have to pick apart the source code, not like, you know, in assembly language, people would extract nice little things from the ROMs that would let me sort of look at the individual channels, the music, and I understood some of the tricks that a lot of the old composers would use because I was dissecting all this music, and I'd even dissect some of the sound effects and see how they made those too. And all of a sudden I found myself with a large body of knowledge of how video game hardware made music, and I played a festival with Metroid Metal in 2009 called Penny Arcade Expo in Seattle. And at that festival, I saw some people making music on Nintendo Game Boys out on the street with an amplifier hooked up to a car battery. It was like the most punk rock thing I'd ever seen in my life.
This is again where?
At Penny Arcade Expo in Seattle.
Yeah, Seattle. So I got to imagine, you know, they got a lot of stuff connected to car batteries out there for...
Yeah. And it was super punk rock. They were throwing a concert on the street, and it was this chiptune dance party with Game Boys, and they had a huge crowd just dancing in the street. It was amazing. And I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. I had been studying video game hardware for probably 4 or 5 years now, and I didn't realize people were making new original music using video game hardware. And I was like, wow, I want to do that. This is cool. This is exciting. People are making new sounds I've never heard before. And I just wanted to pick it up myself. And so I had a big head start because I sort of understood the limitations in the hardware and some of the sounds that already could be made and some of the tricks that were used in old games. And it really came very naturally to me. I felt like it was a test that I had been studying for several years before I took it without knowing.
And so now you're here. Tell me about you as a musician coming from your solo album roots all the way to now Lunaria.
So initially, Danimal Canon, the chiptune side project, was how all side projects start. It was a dumb sort of expression for me that wasn't supposed to be anything. It was just going to be some backing tracks. I was going to play a couple shows around town, and I was going to play as many guitar solos as I wanted. It was going to be kind of a jam band sort of thing. But it turns out that I don't really write jam band sort of music. I write weird, intricate sort of heavy metal tunes that have tons of detail. And so what came out was something a little bit differently. And there was already such a vibrant scene of chiptune musicians that when I started playing shows, all of a sudden, after my first show, I had show offers in New York City and Philadelphia and some other places, and I was like, oh, this is cool. And then I went and played in Rochester in a basement because they had a really cool punk rock chiptune scene going on there. And I was like, wow, there's a really awesome, fun scene going on for this sort of thing. So I really put a lot of effort into it after that. And all of a sudden, years later, now I have 3 albums. I've played on 5 continents, I think. I think it's 5. Maybe it's 4. North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. Okay, so that's 4, right?
Wow. South America is somehow not one of those.
Yeah, haven't made it out there. I've made it to Mexico, but haven't been invited to play any chiptune shows in South America. One day, though.
One day.
Yeah.
We'll get there. I know. I think about that because Reina Kendo is a local regional band, and they've done some chiptune stuff of their own.
So I recently heard that band, and they're amazing.
Yeah.
So I did a tour with a chiptune metal band from Europe called Machine Supremacy, and my merch girl, Jana, I love you. She was like, oh, you need to check out my favorite band, Reign of Kindo. And I had never heard them before. And I was like, this band's amazing. And she's like, oh, yeah, they're from Buffalo. And I was like, what? How is this possible? So shout out to Jana and Reign of Kindo.
This is an 8-bit version of Reign of Kindo's song, Romancing a Stranger. They have a lot of fans in South America. That's why I brought it up.
Do you have any, like, strange, like, fan bases that have cropped up from this where you're just like, I did not expect to get fans from here, but here we are?
Let me think about it. I have a lot of fans that are transgender, actually, which it's not something that, like, I don't think that's, like, a core demographic that I appeal to in any sort of, you know, meaningful way, but it might just be sort of the way that the chiptune scene sort of skews. It was not a fan base that I sort of ever tried to have, but it just cropped up. And it's actually been really nice, actually, because before that I really didn't know any transgender people, and since then I've been able to sort of meet a lot of people and hear a lot of nuanced sort of, discussions about gender and sexuality and things like that that I probably wouldn't have come across otherwise. So it's really been a great sort of educational thing for me to be able to, you know, meet these people And I never would have guessed it, but yeah, that's something that one day I was like, wow, I have a lot of transgender fans, and I have no idea why. I don't know, you know, if I just have this quality to me, but I don't think it's me. I don't know.
Kind of an inclusionary environment?
Maybe. And I can't put words to it, but it's actually been really beneficial for me as a person to grow. And, you know, I'm really thankful for that.
So shout out to all your transgender fans?
Yeah, yeah. You guys are awesome. And yeah. Girls and people who don't want to have any sort of gender label. You're all awesome.
And so let's change gears a little bit and let's talk about, you talked about going from your album, and it's really interesting your development, talking about how you grew up with Nintendo and, you know, of course, did not exactly just phase out of video games. I want to talk about influences that you listen to when you talk about 8-bit, because one thing when we talk about chiptune, that's always fun to go back to because it's kind of like new history, right? It's not too old, but there's a history to it, right? And everybody, you know, thinks of Koji Kondo and some of these names and Uematsu, but who are some of your influences that you really dig into when you talk about listening to the original Nintendo soundtracks?
So going back to the old games, I think my favorite composer for the NES is someone called Bun Bun. I cannot remember his name. So a funny story about old video game composers. The story that I heard was they used fake names in the credits of games in order to prevent other studios from poaching talent. So the composer, when you beat Castlevania 1, is James Banana. The composer of Mega Man 3 is Bun Bun. And there's a bunch of other ones. And that's the story that I heard. I don't know if that's 100% correct, but they use fake names. I think Tecmo Super Bowl, that is composed by NJ Jets, New Jersey Jets. Close enough. They play in New Jersey. It's technically correct. And
everybody in Buffalo will really like that.
Right, exactly. And I don't know a lot of the names by heart, and sometimes I've read them, and they're, you know, Japanese names that I read them, and I go, oh, okay, cool, and then I don't speak Japanese, so it's not something I commit to memory. But Bun Bun did Mega Man 3 and a lot of the sound effect work and some of the music for Mega Man 4, some of my favorite stuff ever. James Banana of Castlevania 1, Castlevania 3's composer, that I think is the best NES soundtrack of all time. All the Konami games, it's difficult to know who composed for the Konami games because they usually listed it as Konami Sound Team. So they had a team of people and you had to know who was on what roster at that time. And a lot of this information actually wasn't known at all until recently. And now some historians are kind of going through old interviews and translating Japanese magazines and things like that and asking questions for some of these old composers, like, oh, who was doing this? Who was doing that? Because it really was not well documented who did what. Up until only a couple of years ago, a lot of times nobody knew who was making these games. In fact, Mega Man 2, you were singing the theme to Mega Man 2 earlier. Or not the theme, but the
level 1, level 2, Wily stage.
Exactly.
Theme, yeah.
And there was an interview with that composer recently that a friend of mine did. And he asked him, how do you feel, you know, knowing that your music is loved by so many people? And he's like, I didn't know until today. You're the first person that ever told me that you love this music. And that was literally 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that the composer from Mega Man 2 just found out that people loved the soundtrack to Mega Man 2 and have done literally thousands, tens of thousands of covers of that music. Kind of incredible.
That is something that stands out because it's like this incredible, the reuse of it too. Like the new Smash Brothers game that
right.
is out for the Nintendo Switch. I mean, that is, they use so much of this old catalog of music. I'd love to go back and actually do a little bit of research to see how much of it is actually music that is from after the Super Nintendo era and how much that is reused just from Super Nintendo down with the music they have for the game, whether it be Kirby or Zelda or Castlevania or Mega Man Mega Man. From the brief that I've played of this game, that theme I was humming, it's partially why it came right to mind,
right.
was just last night I'm playing the game and that theme is in the game for a Metal Mega Man stage they have
now. I'm pretty sure that the original composers, you know, they were just sort of working for hire for the studio, so they don't actually own the rights to this music and stuff like that. So a lot of times the only people that would be consulted when using that music would be the original studios. They wouldn't, you know, talk directly to the composer. It's only until recently that people are sort of seeking them out and saying, hey, we love what you did, not, you know, what Capcom did or, you know. So in that way, it's not super surprising that, you know, these people never wouldn't even know that Smash Brothers is remaking the Mega Man 2 Wily theme. But I'm sure they have an idea now. Nintendo always does such a killer job with their audio. Whatever team they have, like, oh, I'm doing the Italian kiss of food. Mwah. Yes, yeah. Just perfection. Yeah. Nintendo, love it.
Yeah, and so I do want to bring up the fact, too, before I get too far. I want to talk about one person, and it's just to get your thoughts on him, because he's such an influence to progressive rockers when it came to some chiptune audio, as far as him concerned, and you can give a little insight on him, the man who created one of the most low-key soundtracks. He never made music for a good game, but Silver Surfer and Pictionary. You want to talk about him a little bit?
So I knew who you were going to bring up. It's Tim Fallon, and he was revolutionary in that he used a lot of really complex musical techniques in chiptune music back on the NES. And he also composed for some other systems, I think like the Commodore 64, and it's been a while.
There's that one in England that he composed. There's a system that was only released in England, too.
It might be the ZX Spectrum.
Yes, I believe so.
It might be FM Towns Marty. There's a couple like low-key systems that I'm not personally very familiar with, but I know that they exist. But Tim Fallon, a lot of the sounds that he used for the NES were actually, you could say, way ahead of their time, in that now in modern times when I'm trying to make an NES or a Game Boy track, I'm trying to sort of push the limits of what's the craziest sound that I can make using this programming. And he was already doing that back in the 80s. And really, nobody else was pushing the hardware anywhere near that far. So if you listen to the intro track from a game called Solstice that he did the music for, it's just an insane progressive rock track with these giant arpeggios that are like 64th note, 12-note arpeggios that crossed, you know, like four octaves. It's really just insane-sounding music. I've seen a few things about him. I'm not an expert. There's one funny thing is an old interview, somebody asked him about, you know, oh, how does it feel to, you know, compose these soundtracks that people were astounded by? And he's like, oh, I don't really like it. I'm glad to not be making that music anymore. And he has since actually sort of revised that opinion, where I think he's appreciated what he did at the time. I think he was so far removed from it, because it was probably a really thankless job composing music back in the day. Nobody knew that you did it. You'd have to beat the game on some impossible game anyways to get a fake name to come up at the end of the game. It's disheartening to know that, you know, maybe they didn't get the credit that they deserve. But now his music is incredibly influential. If I had one criticism to say, that he didn't always write music that fit the game. He just wrote sweet progressive rock tracks. Pictionary is one great example where the music really stands out as like a poor but amazing fit. Like, why not? Why not have insane tracks going on? There's a track in Treasure Master that does one of the most insane things I've ever heard. It does a crossfade using monophonic instruments between two tracks. It does that by doing a progressive interrupt of two separate tracks. I've never heard anyone do anything like it, and there's no reason why he needed to do it either. I'm sure that he just needed to, like, oh, I bet you I could do this, and he did an experiment in a game where he did a live crossfade using monophonic channels on an NES, in Treasure Master. Really just insane stuff. He's one of a kind.
Yeah, and you mentioned to me in the past before that, you know, listening to that, you know, it's almost impossible to listen to that and not be influenced at all, especially if you're doing chiptune. And you mentioned Axis had a little bit of influence with that, right?
Right. So the track Axis, which is the first track off my latest album, Lunaria, I sort of borrowed the idea to use those wild, gigantic arpeggios that he uses in tracks like Solstice and Silver Surfer. And I really wanted to accentuate and push the programming to go as far as it could go. To be honest, the real influence for that track was I was performing a gig opening for a band called Animals as Leaders, and I'm a big fan of them, and they're a really complex, shreddy band, and I was feeling a little intimidated. I was like, oh man, I have to write something that's really going to fit the bill, like a crazy progressive rock track, you know, that uses the craziest, wildest sounds I can. And so I wrote Axis to sort of fit in on that bill, and that's why that track got made. And I borrowed a lot of influence from Tim Follin when I was making that track.
On Lunaria, you have the piano track at the end of it too, which really I think kind of stands out. It's so juxtaposing hearing the opening track Axis and then hearing how it ends. You also kind of hear some of the crazy ideas that you're putting together as a composer coming to life, and then you hear all of a sudden it's here on a piano, and it's just like, wow, there's so much going on, and yet they're almost like two entirely different tracks as well when you listen to them.
So the story behind the piano version of that track was there's an artist who I had collaborated with before on my first album, Roots, named Shnabubala, which is a ridiculous name, but on the internet you can be whoever you want to be. And he is an exceptional piano player, just absolute top tier. I am positive that Axis performance is a single take where he just, yep, I'm going to do that. And he asked me, he's like, oh, well, what do you want me to do? You know, what track do you want me to cover? Because I had come up with an idea. I was like, hey, what if you did like a version of one of my tracks? And I was like, I'm going to give him the hardest one just to see what happens, because this track is by all means impossible to play. I did that on purpose. And I just was curious to see what would come out. And he did an incredible job. There's some piano shredding on that track. It's also, I guess, the point of it was, oh, hey, what would this sound like on traditional or more accepted instruments? You know, let's hear the song in a way that might be more palatable to someone who isn't used to hearing sort of chiptune music, because it can be a little strange or abrasive if you're not used to hearing it.
For me, it's like finding another appreciation for the piece of music again. And I think that's the same way for a lot of people who maybe listen to one of their favorite 8-bit or 16-bit tracks and then they see it reorchestrated and it's like finding a new love for it again.
Right. So I think there's two things that happen in our brain. Sometimes we hear something new and unexpected and we go, oh, here's some dopamine. This is fun. And then also we get a dopamine hit when we hear something that we remember and be like, oh, hey, I remember that. And so a lot of times a reimagining of a track that you know very well, sort of like a cover of an 8-bit song, so like what Arm Cannon and Metroid Metal would do, you would get a twofer where you'd hear something that I already know and, oh, cool, I get that dopamine hit from that. But then you also get the other one like, oh, but it's in a new context and it's like I've never heard this before. You know, at least in the short term, it's a really powerful way to make an impact and have something sound really fresh but still familiar. It's a nice combination.
Yeah, and it comes off that way. Now you're saying it, now I'm thinking about it now too, and it's just like now I'm thinking of it in a different way. It's like totally, yeah, that whether it's Metroid Metal or Video Games Live or
oh, yeah.
or one of those things, I'm getting hyped.
Nostalgia is a powerful thing, and I will say there is a shelf life to nostalgia. There's only so many Mega Man 2 Wily remixes I can hear before I kind of don't care anymore, which is sad to say, and I don't mean to say that in a dark way. After, you know, covering video game music for, you know, so many years, it's not as exciting as it was to me in 2003. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a dark, depressing way, but for me, it's more fun to make new original music. And it's kind of crazy now that I get to write music for video games. And the fact that I was studying video game music for all this time, again, it's like a test that I didn't know that I was studying for. And making new things now, that's more exciting to me than going back and covering things, just because I've done it and I've heard it and it's still fun to play the tracks and it's still fun to play shows and stuff like that. But I definitely don't have the desire to sort of cover songs as much anymore. Now it's time for me to, you know, make my own mark and make my own tunes. And that's been a big reason why, you know, Danimal Canon has sort of come out of, you know, these bands that were covering video game music.
For somebody who's like, hey, I'm liking what I hear, right? I'm loving hearing Danimal Canon and this is awesome. And whether it's Axis or Rhapsody, this sounds cool. What would you recommend for like baby's first chiptune? What would you say here? Here is the chiptune music besides, you know, the stuff you're playing.
So there's a couple different ways you can go. I like songs that, you know, sound like old video games, and I like things that push the hardware to its limits and don't even sound like a video game system anymore. And there's a couple different ways you can go. There's an artist named Chibitech that does sort of these insane EDM tracks, but also does more than that. But it's some of the most intense sounding Nintendo music that I have seen it blow up clubs before, where just people are freaking out. Absolutely massive. I'm performing with her in later this month. By the time this airs, I might have already performed with her. She's incredible. There's an artist named Vert. He goes by Jake Kaufman. I collaborated with him on a video game soundtrack called Proton Pulse, and he has done the soundtrack for Shovel Knight, all the Shovel Knight games, and a bunch of other things. He's got 4 albums out that are all just chiptune stuff and a bunch of other tracks in addition to that. And he is, I think he's going to be the legendary composer to hear in as years go by, where, like, I think he's going to make a giant mark on just music in general. Like, I think his work is that strong and that amazing that if he gets some more publicity, he's going to be one of the great composers of our time. And I try not to say that with hyperbole, and I'm friends with Jake, and I'm not trying to, you know, kiss up to him or anything, but, like, man, he is really good. So, yeah, Jake Kaufman and Chibitech are two of my favorites.
Yeah. So there's your baby's first chiptune if you're getting into it. And talk a little bit about, too, getting into game composition as well. I mean, like repurposing it and it covering it. But, you know, how has that been going, composing for games?
So when you compose music for hire, it's like the Iron Chef, where you, let's say you're a chef and they're like, hey, we want you to make this kind of dish. We want you to make spaghetti or something. But then they'll give you some random ingredient that you have to incorporate that's insane. So they'll be like, yeah, you have to make spaghetti, but you have to use, I don't know, cumin or something. And that has to be part of your dish. And so you have to use all your skills as a chef and knowing all your flavor palettes and everything. And you have to think on the fly and make something new. Composing for video games is a lot like that. I've had to do tracks where they're like, oh, all right, we want something that's like Pokemon or sort of Final Fantasy battle music, but we want it to sound like it's coming out of a fax modem, a dial-up modem or something like that.
Has that been something that's really been said?
Yeah, no, I really made that track. and there's a couple other examples, but a lot of times it's sort of like, I ask for a reference material. I'm like, hey, give me an example of something that you might like. Because a lot of times I'm working with computer programmers and artists, and they don't have the musical vocabulary to be like, all right, we want something in a minor key at this sort of tempo, you know, with these sorts of resolutions or whatever. They don't have that vocabulary, and that's fine. So a lot of times having a reference track can kind of say, oh, hey, I want something that with this sort of composition, you know, from this track, but like the sound design of another track or something like that. And you have to do these on-the-fly cross-betweens. And it's a challenge. Every single time sometimes I say, like, I don't know if I could do this, and then I just sort of put down some notes, and it's actually worked out really well for me so far. It's really pushed me as a musician to work outside my comfort zone. I had to make a dubstep track earlier this year. I've never made a dubstep track. I was kind of surprised because it sounded way better than it had any right to sound for baby's first dubstep track, where someone's like, that just sounds like a professional dubstep track. And I was like, yeah, I never did this before.
It's got to be a great feeling.
Yeah, it was so much work, though. I killed myself. Just every 30 seconds of that dubstep drop, like actually every 5 seconds of drop took me about, I don't know, half an hour or an hour to really get the sound design where I wanted it. And it was worth it, but I had to kill myself and really get out of my comfort zone to make it happen. And I get challenges like that all the time, and it's hard, but it makes you better.
And what game was that?
That was for a game called Just Shapes and Beats that came out earlier this year for the Nintendo Switch and Steam. And they actually didn't end up using that track. Funny story. They were having trouble securing licenses for one of the tracks in the game, and the game was set to release later in the month. So they were like, we need a replacement track, like, yesterday, because this person's not answering our emails, we can't get a hold of them, and we have to release this game, and we don't have the releases for this track. And they built the whole level around it, and they were like, hey, Dan, could you do this? And I did it. I made a replacement track for him, and then the original artist got back to them, and they're like, well, we're going to use this track. So I ended up challenging myself. I still got paid. It's, you know, it's completely fine. That happens all the time. Is sometimes I wrote a track for a level that ended up not being used. It was like a background menu, like, oh, actually, we're not going to use this section of the game and stuff like that. It happens all the time, and didn't hurt my feelings or anything. And I got to push myself as a musician, and I got paid to write a song that no one's ever heard.
I did want to talk about you had a TED Talk.
I did.
And you talked about these constraints, and it's an awesome, awesome explanation for somebody who is looking to try to understand a little bit more of the technical side. But there's a couple of things you talk about in your TED Talk, like talking about specifically going crazy. You talk in detail about how to kind of get the most out of your instrument and different chiptuners doing different things. That's a little bit older. I wanted to ask, following up on that, you know, where do you see chiptune now moving forward?
That's a really tough question because I really don't know where chiptune is going. I don't know if it has sort of reached a point where maybe it won't go too much further. However, I will say every once in a while, you know, I hear a track that somebody puts out and I'm like, wow, I've never heard anyone make any music like that before. There's a Australian artist named Aqualex that is doing some Game Boy tracks that are just out of this world, chaotic, like out of control. I've never heard anyone use the instrument like that. And I will say, you know, being in this scene for about 8 or 9 years now and hearing, you know, thousands of tracks and thousands of artists and playing thousands of shows, I don't get as excited as I used to, or I don't hear as many new things anymore. It has slowed down a little bit because, I don't know, genres get and instruments get a little stagnant once in a while. And I had actually been looking away from chiptune for a long time now to sort of make new music that excited me more, because that's just where puppy dog brain goes. Like, oh, what's the new exciting thing? That's but I had recently played a bunch of shows on a tour with this band called Psycho Stick, and we did a bunch of shows, and the audiences that came out to that show, or those shows, I should say, had never heard chiptune music before, and I'd been playing so many shows at, like, game festivals and, like, shows that the chiptune scene sort of runs that people had already seen this. It's old hat. You know, people weren't – it wasn't new and exciting anymore. And playing these shows with Psycho Stick, it was like, wow, people have not – heard this. Every single show, dozens of people would be like, I've never heard anything like this. And it's easy for me to forget, because I've been sort of in these scenes for such a long time now that you get this tunnel vision and you forget that, like, literally 95% of the world has never seen anyone make live music with a Game Boy. And it sort of had me go, maybe there is more new music. I need to make more music on Game Boys. And, you know, I need to play for more people. My work is not done yet. And I can tell that, you know, the chiptune scene has stagnated a little bit. Some of the local scenes and some of the festivals are less prevalent than they were when I had started. And that's a little sad to me. But I have a feeling there'll be another wave. It comes in waves, right? Every scene, you know, like ska, it dies down for a little bit, and then it comes back up stronger than ever, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's God, I live with somebody who absolutely, like, lives by ska, so that's – every time Mustard Plug comes around, he's just like, we're going! It's happening! It's at Mohawk! We're doing it!
Oh, man. There was a gym stakeout around town that would play, like, punk ska every time that I went in there. And that's about all the ska I needed in my life, was about once every 3 weeks, about two songs. Mm-hmm. But I got to say, it was pretty fun. I wouldn't consider myself a ska guy, but I could get into it.
That's awesome. You're awesome. Thank you so much for being here. Now, got to ask one more question, which is, where can people find your stuff?
I have all my stuff on, you know, the usual sites. You got your iTunes and your Spotify's and your Google Plays and whatever's. I tend to really like a site called Bandcamp. They really keep the artist in mind. I usually pack in some extras. So, for example, if you download my album off of Bandcamp, I usually include as a downloadable file the Game Boy source save files that come with it. And so if you're a chiptune composer, you could actually open up my files that the songs are on and actually study the programming in it. And I do that because when I was getting started, I would study the save files of artists that I really liked and tried to figure out, oh, how did they make that sound and how did they do that? And so sites like Bandcamp really let me release music the way I want to release it. A lot of the other sites have, like, gatekeepers and music industry sort of tie-ins that are kind of difficult to work with. And Bandcamp really keeps itself artist-centric and really friendly, and I love the work they're doing. And that would be my primary site that I buy all my music on.
Gotcha. And is there any future news on stuff you're working on for the upcoming year?
So I'm working on this idea. I really fell in love with this Japanese thing called Vocaloid, which is synthetic vocalists. And they use avatars that are usually anime characters to sing the music live using holographic projection. And it's a huge undertaking. It's very different from my chiptune stuff, and the technology is exceptionally complicated and difficult, and it's been a fun challenge. I've had to study linguistics to figure out how to program voices saying words, but I have learned a lot, and I don't know if the project will ever be good enough or if I'll ever wrangle the technology to really do my grandiose vision of what I want to do with it. But I've been working with that technology. I have found that vocals are the most human element of music. It's the most direct sort of thing that we can do. And when you remove the humanity from music completely by making the vocal synthetic, people have a very averse reaction to that. It really makes people feel uneasy. And I didn't – that never happened to me. That wasn't my thought. But I've noticed on some of the YouTube videos that I've posted using this stuff, people hate it. People absolutely hate the sound of synthetic vocals. And it's my job to convince them that they are wrong. And I don't know if it'll ever end up happening, but I am working with this crazy thing that isn't done very much in America. It's much more popular in Japan. I'm a big nerd. I got to follow my big nerd desires.
Yeah, and we'll see where it goes. And they can follow you on YouTube as well?
Yeah. I think on YouTube, I'm just Danimal Cannon. You can just find me on there. And I don't post too much stuff on there, but I do have a bunch of live videos and all my tracks are on there. Some people, like myself, like listening to music on YouTube too. So that's another place you can find my music.
Go Bills?
Yeah, go Bills.